Hello, and welcome to another episode of CDH Conversations. My name is Brigitte Mangel, and I'm a director in CDH's pro bono and human rights practice, where my work primarily focuses on advancing women's rights and strengthening access to justice. Now, for South Africans, the period between Freedom Day on the 27th of April and Workers' Day on the 1st of May invites reflection, not only on how far we've come, but also on what freedom really looks like today. Because while our Constitution promises freedom, equality, and dignity, the lived reality for millions raises a very difficult question. What does freedom really mean without economic security? Today's conversation explores that question through the lens of social protection, social grants, and access to justice. I'm joined by Black Sash Executive Director, Rachel Bukasa. Rachel, welcome. Thank you very much for joining.
Thank you so much for having me.
For those who may not be familiar, Black Sash has a long history as a human rights organization committed to advancing social justice and dignity. It was founded in Johannesburg in 1955 as a non-violent resistance organization for liberal women. And it ultimately derived its name from the women's habit of wearing black sashes during their protest meetings. The black sashes represented their mourning for the South African Constitution. The early days of Black Sash campaigned against the removal of people of color from the voters' roll in the Cape Province. And as the apartheid system began to work its way into every aspect of South African lives, Black Sash members protested against past laws and other apartheid legislation. They would later open advice offices to provide information about their legal rights to non-white South Africans affected by that legislation. These advice offices played a crucial part in the organization's brave and principled role as a key component in civil society at the time. Rachel, please would you help me begin our conversation by telling us what is the work of Black Sash today and how are you seeing that show up in the lives of the communities you serve?
So from the beginning, Black Sash has always been a movement that was for the people. And as you correctly stated, started as a anti-apartheid movement. But post-94, when democracy came, I think the last thing those ladies thought about was then they would have to be fighting a government that they helped put in power. And the reason for that is that even though freedom came, the economic freedom that was needed to give effect to that safe freedom didn't happen. You know, stats show that South Africa has the highest inequality rate in the world. So the rich are really rich and the poor are really poor. There isn't that middle ground. And so now that we've got freedom, it was a conversation about, are people really through these freedoms? Or are we doing a box ticking exercise where we've got this constitution that is praised, but the lived realities are different? And so Sash's role was now to bridge that gap between this amazing constitution that everyone tells us around the world that is the best versus people's lived realities. I understood that it needed to stand in the gap for the people that were now left behind. In 94, it became a professionalized organization and took on that role. But what that looks like today is we've got two key programs. The one is comprehensive social protection. For the benefit of the conversation, the social protection floor is an idea that many countries apply, countries in fact even weaker than us, but we don't. But it's this, if you'd imagine a net, a safety net under society. So should you be destitute, should you go without a job, should you be in trouble, this net catches you. But with the intent of you bouncing back, right? It's not catches you and leaves you there. And so each society needs the safety net in order to be effective. We see it in some of other countries in the world. The idea is that you have a month or two, and then you're able to be absorbed back in the job market and right. What we have in South Africa is, one, we don't have that. And the quote-unquote attempt at safety net we have is problematic because there isn't an ability to bounce back into a job market. I mean, we've got an unemployment rate of 47% for the youth. And so even if you have the willingness to want to bounce back, there's nowhere to bounce to use that analogy. And so you have this system that is catching people at a bare minimum, and then people are stranded there. So that's the first arm of the web, the calling for a social protection floor to be implemented in South Africa. Weaker economies have done it. There's no reason why we shouldn't. But the second arm of the work is what we call our Making Justice Real program. It's where we understand that our roots are as an advice office organization. but we're not able to be everywhere all the time. So we capacitate advice officers. We run a helpline. You call us, we'll talk free, whatever it is. If we can't help you, we'll put you in touch with someone who can. Mm-hmm. And we train paralegals as well. The idea is that every community has that one clever person that they go to. Really? And so we capacitate the clever person, okay, quote unquote,
yeah,
so that they can assist the community. And what does that assistant look like? That assistance looks like, this is the constitution you said, and these are the promises in there, and I'm entitled to them, and how do I claim those rights? So it's helping that process of claiming those rights. So we do it by, you know, helping people, whether it's with their SASSA grants, whether there are rights issues, mm-hmm, whether it's monitoring how government is executing its obligations under social protection floor, mm-hmm, or when it's going to court. And going to court is because a policy change is important. So those are the two key things that SASH is focused on 70 years on.
70 years on. Wow. It's incredible to hear the work you're doing. And it's making me think about, you know, how hard, especially in recent times, it's become for people just to survive. Mm. So what are you seeing on the ground right now in terms of accessing social grants and basic services?
Sure. Look, it's a social protection mechanism that is deeply under pressure.
Yeah.
And we are seeing people who are also under pressure. We're not just talking about, you know, the poorest of the poor. Mm-hmm. We're talking middle class. You might feel under pressure. You just go to a store. That's all you have to know. And when we talk about the economic difficulties that are happening, a majority of the people we're talking about are women, because women are the people that are carrying the brunt of this. Mm. When one woman receives a grant, it's the household that's fed. Mm. And so what we're seeing is a social protection mechanism that's not working.
Mm.
So the few people that are able to get, you know, whether it's the children's grant, whether it's the old age grant or the disability grant, we see that the amounts are not keeping up with inflation, firstly. And so, for example, I stand to be corrected, but I mean, if we're at $650 for a child grant or something like that, that just takes into account just feeding. There isn't schooling, there isn't transport, there isn't care. And what you're seeing there is people essentially being prisoners in their own communities, in their own country, to these issues. But aside from that, it's not even an issue of saying that, well, people should just look for better jobs. There are jobs.
Right.
We have people who want jobs. And I want to, you know, put a paragraph here, what is it, a bracket here, and say, you know, when we talk about grants or social protection, the argument is immediately, oh, no, but you're creating a welfare state.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're making people lazy. Now, let's pause on that for a second. To hold that view is to hold a privilege to you. Mm-hmm. And let me explain why. Only a privileged person would think that logic doesn't apply to the poor. If you and I went to lunch, we wouldn't spend 350 rand, right? It would be more. So why would we think that the poor would rather give up a salary in exchange for 350 and a certain grant? What, we're saying that logic doesn't apply to the poor? Mm-hmm. No, I promise you, if you gave people the option of a salary or 350, they would take a salary. I mean, studies have shown that the 350 or 370, now that it is, couldn't even buy a loaf of bread every day for a month. And so to hold that view is to come from a privileged place. Yeah. No, the poor also want the dignity that comes from a salary, the dignity that comes from, you know, providing, putting food on the table.
Yeah.
But there isn't. So calling for grants is not about, oh, we don't want people to work. Absolutely. We want people to work. People want to be able to work.
Mm-hmm.
But with 30 years in, government has not been able to create a job market. So until then, what happens to people? Until when are we, quote unquote, teaching to fish?
Yeah.
And so I just want to close that bracket around this idea where people feel uncomfortable with this idea that government should be supporting the destitute.
Yes. There's got to be some kind of solution, right? You know, so you've touched on it a little bit, but I want to delve deeper into the framing of something that's often misunderstood, and that is what grants are and what they aren't. So you very rightly guided us that grants are not charity, but they fit into our constitutional framework. And so how would you say we should be viewing grants, and how do you think they enable democracy and participation in democracy?
Yeah. So grants exactly are that. They are not charity.
Yeah.
They are not a favor. They are a constitutional obligation, right? So our constitution provides for the right to social protection.
Mm-hmm.
It offers a right to housing, you know, all those, Section 26, 27, all those rights. So firstly, grants are a way of giving effect to constitutional provisions, okay? So they're not a favor. And the reason why it's important to insist on that is, mm-hmm, one, government takes it as a favor. You'll see politicians every time it's about to be election time. Oh, well, if you don't vote for us, the grants are gone.
Imagine.
It's not a carrot you dangle.
Yeah.
And then you'll see the same attitude at grant payment officer sites, where the staff feel that they're doing people a favor. And so you'll come, old ladies, those disabled and not alike are standing outside in the rain, 8 hours, no bathroom, no water, because we're doing a favor. No one is doing anyone a favor. This is a mechanism of giving rights to a constitutional obligation. That's the first thing. But what grants does to the world and the country as we know it is it allows people to participate in an economy that they normally wouldn't have been able to participate. What we see, contrary to the propaganda that, you know, people who believe in, you know, tough austerity measures and not a people-centered approach, is that when people receive these grants, they go, they start selling fruit on the side. That allows school fees to be paid. When young people or people that are in trouble get these grants, that means you've got the 370 man. You can go to an internet cafe, print the CV, get on a taxi, attend an interview, have a time to job hunt. You know, they ensure that people take part in the economic cycle. And in fact, the informal sector is as a result of a lot of people taking this little grant and trying to multiply it. Studies have shown, you know, people make the emotional argument about, well, if people are given grants, then people are just lazy and nothing works. But studies have shown that when a country has strong mechanisms such as grants, is that people are able to bounce back and go into the job space without which they wouldn't normally have been able to do. So it enables democracy, it enables dignity, it enables freedom, because those words are attractive as long as you're not hungry.
Ooh.
When you're hungry, I assure you,
I want to hear about.
No one wants to hear about democracy and freedom and how I'm experiencing it. My stomach is rumbling.
Absolutely.
And so that conversation can't happen without the basics being done.
Yeah.
And the basics need to be done not as a favor, but because, one, we have enough for everyone. But it has to be known that it's our responsibility to make sure that the call for a grant or a basic income support grant or the call for a social protection floor is our job. And right now, people don't realize the importance of it because they think it's not going to be there. But realistically, even us as a middle class, we're 4 or 5 paychecks away.
From relying very heavily on that
from mechanism. Being in that queue.
Absolutely. And so now that we have a deeper understanding of that framework, that constitutional framework, and what a grant is and isn't, and, you know, how it allows one to ultimately live a dignified life, I want to talk more about the connection between freedom and material survival. How do dignity and social security connect in practice? You've hinted at it, you know, having to stand in a queue and having to engage with a state official who thinks they're doing you a favor is very hard to bear on top of the economic strain. What are your thoughts on the relationship between dignity and social security?
Yeah. So in order to answer that, right, we need to ask, what does freedom mean when you're hungry?
Yeah.
What does it mean to be free when you are in the shackles of poverty?
Yeah.
What does it mean to be free when you can see your country being enjoyed by the Germans, the Americans who brag about how cheap it is, and you haven't had bread for the day, and you know your kids are home because there were no school fees? So what does it mean to be free? What this does is it creates, and I think anyone who's stepped foot outside will know, it creates an us versus them.
Oh, yeah.
The free ones in our society.
Yeah.
And those of us who aren't, those of us who don't matter. Yeah. So grants are an enabling mechanism to ensure that the way we have failed as government, we have failed as society to look after the poorest of the poor, they are able to get back into the system. Dignity is an inalienable right?
Yes.
Human right.
Yeah.
But without money, without the ability to eat, that strips away your dignity.
Of course.
We ran a child nutrition project in some of the very rural areas of the country, just looking at what does it mean, what does it look like, you know, feeding schemes, if any, like that. And one of the things we found was a deep-seated sense of shame that the parents carried for their inability to be able to feed their children. And one of the ladies, in fact, spoke about how the moms in the community cope is that when the kids come back from school, they take, you know, the big pointy course pot and fill it with water and put it on the coals. And now the children, as they came, they are under the impression that food is coming and prevents them from crying because they know food is coming. And the idea is that they'll keep topping it up with water until the kids eventually get tired enough to fall asleep. Then the excuse can be, well, you fell asleep and so you missed dinner. All of that just not to be seen as being unable to provide.
Yeah.
I think a couple of years ago, we've seen on the news a mom kill herself and her children simply because they were hungry. And we cannot, as a society, pretend that that's them, this is us.
Yeah.
And as long as we do that, that's why we're going to keep having this deep-seated divide where this constitution and the ideas of dignity and freedom are for some and not for the rest of us. Yeah. So it's an enabling factor without which there's a deep sense of, I want to use the word nakedness.
Absolutely.
Vulnerability.
Yes, yes.
And that you're begging for
shame
the payment
and
of it.
Fear and
exactly.
Yeah, all of it.
Yeah. And then we see it even when the people start moving to middle class. So you know how the entire community chips in, sends one kid to university.
Yes.
Sends one kid to university. The kid does the best he or she can. But that one salary of that junior kid now needs to take care of 10 people back home, 12 people back home. And then you wonder why this junior professional is unable to climb the ladder as fast as their peers are. That's because it's something that it doesn't end with one generation.
Yeah. And you know, all of these issues just remind us of how important it is for all of us to just move through life with compassion and to pause and consider what other people are going through and what privileges we may be taking for granted. And I think it's sometimes easy to forget that in some way, shape, or form, those of us who can do things like this and who are in the middle class, we ourselves are privileged, notwithstanding the struggles that we as the middle class may also be feeling. I want to move to a discussion around something that's in the headlines a lot recently and something we can't ignore, and that's the difficulty and the disruption in the SASSA system. So we've been seeing issues with payment distribution, card migration, and even concerns around fraud. What would you say the recent disruptions are identifying about the grant system as a whole?
So I like the fact that you called it recent disruption because it's continuous. It's not, you know, a surprise. But the grant system as a whole is not well managed.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not well managed. And there's now an attempt at these disruptions. So when you talk to, I mean, we work really closely on monitoring SASSA and that kind of thing. They'll say that, well, the recent disruption as a result of grant reviewing, so we need to make sure that those who are not supposed to be getting grants are not getting grants. Okay. No one disagrees, but there are ways things get done. So what happened was that they decided to, quote unquote, review grants, but they didn't communicate with anyone. So what happened was that you went to the office on your grant payday and you were told your grant's getting reviewed. What does that mean? It won't explain to you. What do you need to do to pass this review process? You weren't told. And it resulted in back and forth about 8 times for a person to then get grant assistance. And so while the motive that they cite was good, it's about implementation, because the reality of me going to a grant office and not getting aid is that my family went hungry that night. Do you get what I mean? So a family went hungry that night. There were kids who did not go to school because there was no transport. And so while that full process was there, what was not done was the proper execution of it. So a simple thing, again, this is why I have a thing about how we treat the poor, right? And how we think it's something you and I would never tolerate.
Absolutely.
If we went to a bank and this whole process was happening and you didn't get an email, it's something we would never tolerate, but we assume that the poor should just put up with it, at least thankful they get helped. Yeah. So one, it was the issue around communication. No one who's in the grant system wants others who shouldn't be getting there to benefit, number one. But number two, reports themselves have showed that the bulk of the corruption is internal. SASSA officials themselves are all receiving grants. Yes, they do these media shows where once in a while, you know, some people get prosecuted. But a bulk of it is that. So why are you not showing us the internal processes of rooting out corruption? Why is the rooting out corruption already faced one way? So that's the one thing. And then there's a clear issue with SASSA around the infrastructure of framing grants itself that is deeply broken. They pushed for this online system and now it's constant systems are down. And I think I have to bring Postbank in it. I mean, it's not like they are scot-free. They are just as problematic in this agreement, but where the infrastructure is not there. And so it's aimed at frustrating people from getting grants. Okay. The idea is to frustrate you enough to not come. We see it with, you know, people who, you know, the law provides for, you know, people's refugee statuses to get grants, etc. And now it's suddenly like, oh, Sammy, we don't know those documents.
Yes, of course.
But they're issued by You know, so the idea is to frustrate people from getting grants. And that is a cop-out. That is a cop-out because what you should be doing is creating jobs to make sure that people don't need these grants. And now you're deliberately frustrating people's constitutional rights in an attempt at covering yourself and covering your back and a system that can't absorb people. Mm. So that was what that entire review thing was. But realistically, what it meant on the ground was that we saw an influx of calls through our hotline. That's one thing for a young person to try and navigate this. Another thing for 90-year-old to try and navigate this. And so those lib realities, unless you put systems in place, as problematic. The lastly, just on this issue, had a conversation with SAS about, you know, how this was overtaken, what should have happened. There are people, there are organizations around that can help you communicate these things so that people are not inconvenienced. All you had to do was, next month, we are doing this process.
Yeah.
These are the documents you need to show up with.
Yes.
As simple as that.
Yeah. And you know that the system and many systems often rely on a lack of knowledge of your own human rights and how far boundaries can be pushed. And when you are allowed to speak up and defend yourself, that silence and lack of knowledge is relied on all too often. You spoke about, you know, your helplines being inundated with requests for clarity and, you know, guidance as to where to from here. I want to spend some more time on the human impact. Can you tell us more about what these disruptions meant for people on the ground?
So we immediately, when there's a disruption, we see it through our helpline.
Mm.
First, there's a sense of panic.
Of course. Yeah.
In terms of just human impact. There's a sense of panic and disorientation. We're not sure. Have I done something wrong? Before I get to further impact, and this is leading up to the backdrop of this was when we had a system that you would qualify for grant, but if your auntie or someone sent you a little money and then it would count against you and you'd be qualified. So this is the backdrop of that. Right.
Yeah.
So there's an immediate sense of panic of what's gone wrong.
Yeah.
And the second problem is there's no one you can talk to unless you actually physically, you know, sometimes people need someone physically to talk to. It's not an online system. Sometimes I just need to speak to a human, yes, right? And so then when you get there, there's an explanation that at times is in English.
Mm.
With lack of clarity in terms of timelines. And if you do find explanation in Vernac, you would have someone that is deaf or something that isn't someone to use a sign. And so you have this needing various middlemen to get this message across to you. The human impact to that has been that people have further indebted themselves because when there's that gap between payment, we see the loan sharks come in.
Of course.
We see them come in some of the most rural parts of the country. You'll see the SASSA office here and a loan shark right across the road. And we've been doing work with the National Credit Bureau here in terms of just having the conversation about we should criminalize this. We should figure out a way to do this because it's really preying on the most vulnerable.
Of course.
That exists. So we see those people come into play. What we also see then is people's desperation. So like the water, if it's prepaid, you've run out of water, you've run out of food to eat, but also you're unable to get to work the next day. The child's not able to get to school. And so it's got this spiraling effect, essentially, that one thing picks on the other. The other human impact that we see also is now a lack of trust in the systems. It is that if you could do wrong to anyone, you chose us, the poorest of the poor.
Wow.
And so even when SASH, Black SASH as an organization comes in, we're very mindful of the fact that this is people's lived experiences. And you're correct about teaching people how to get their rights. So one arm of the work we do is that, is we go to communities, particularly this year, our focus is on local government elections, because we see that people are most vulnerable when it's time for local government elections, when it's time for national elections. Mm. Suddenly people come in carrying these carrots, we'll pay this, we'll do this, we'll do this, and nothing like that. But what's important is that we go into the communities, we teach where you can claim these rights. Are you going to the South African Human Rights Commission? Mm. Are you writing to, you know, the OMBACs? Are you writing to the public? Where do you go to get these rights?
Mm.
And so that's the kind of work we're doing, because our hope is that when we step out of communities, the communities are able to carry on by themselves, because SASH can't be everywhere.
Yes.
And we shouldn't have to be everywhere. And we shouldn't have to do that. That's government's job. If you are brave enough to tie yourself to this amazing constitution, you should have no problems with everybody claiming those rights, because that's the threshold you set.
Yes.
And now the hope is that, well, let's hide it and hope people, not enough people paying their rights. And that's a deeply problematic stance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what you've just said just reminds us of the importance of administrative justice and accountability. And we need to keep that front of mind, but especially as we prepare to commemorate Freedom Day and Workers' Day, I want to turn more to an unpacking of the state of our unemployment crisis. Over the last 5 years, it's ranged between 31 and 35%. And at times, the youth unemployment rate shoots above 60%. With everything you've said and the constitutional demands and the need for accountability and administrative justice, and particularly against the backdrop of this mass unemployment, how would you say we should be thinking about Workers' Day?
So the first thing we need to think about is when we say worker, who we qualify as worker, right? Mm-hmm. Are we saying just, for example, the people in the formal sector? Are we saying all people in the informal economy count? Mm-hmm. Are we saying it's only documented people? Are we saying it's not documented people? The reason this distinction is important is that if we're going to celebrate Workers' Day for all the workers, that means that that celebration only makes sense if they have the ability to enjoy what being a worker is. Absolutely. And enjoy the protections of being a said worker. Yeah. What we see, however, is that because of the unemployment crisis, you have even people who are working. We have people who are working but are barely making enough to make the malkeld, right? So we have people who are unprotected in terms of their rights. You could come to work today and get fired, and there's no recourse for you. You wouldn't even know where to go for some people. You have people who are quite frankly experiencing modern-day slavery in terms of the space we live in. And so when we talk about a social protection mechanism, for example, is that little boost in addition to the little thing I do gives me a little bit more agency. Gives me a little bit more of wiggle room, which is what we all hope to be doing. And so when we talk about celebrating workers, then we need to see in terms of the protection of workers. How has that been done? You know, we look at the work of SAFTU and COSATU around, you know, workers' protection and what are the recourses they have. One of the things we see clearly is that a Workers' Day that doesn't take into account, or Workers' Day celebration that doesn't grapple with the unemployment rate, is commemorating a reality that no longer exists in South Africa. You're celebrating something that happened long ago. Yeah. For this to be meaningful, you need to take into account what's happening now. And so we need to broaden our understanding of what work is, particularly when we start to have a conversation about unpaid care work. You know, does that constitute work? You know, it should. And so because the reality that we live in is about not having stable work, it's about informal work, it's about unpaid care work. If we only recognize formal employment and celebrate that, I mean, some of us are going to be on holiday because we're in the formal sector. But other people are still going to be reporting to cleaning houses and on that said day. Yeah. And so it has to take into account the lived realities of now. And instead of just celebrating for the sake of celebrating, we need to put mechanisms in place to be able to protect the most vulnerable workers amongst us.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've spoken about formal employment, and that makes me think of South Africa's labor policy. Would you say that social grants are now sort of becoming part of South Africa's labor policy?
Look, they should have been. They should have been, because there isn't enough of a market. But I think it's important that we demarcate the lines carefully.
Sure.
Because I want to say it's even higher than that. It's a constitutional imperative. Because the labor policies change as government changes, as priority shifts. That's not what this is. This isn't the constitutional imperative. But what should have happened, right, in terms of when we look at our labor policies, we should know that, one, a lot of the people, what we're looking at, what, a 60% informal sector, it's more than the formal sector, that are relying on this, it means that something around the labor laws and around the way we've structured labor in the country is not working. So does that mean looking at minimum wage? Does that mean looking at the bare minimum rights? Because, I mean, here you can fight for your rights once you get your CCMA, but an inability to get to CCMA leaves you stranded. And so that's what we need to be taking care of. Should we be making those minimum wages? Should we be re-looking at the number? And more than just talking about government systems, let's talk about you and me, the everyday person who's watching this and thinking, well, that's not really my problem. Is your domestic worker fairly paid? You know, is your gardener fairly paid? Or is it, well, to take it or leave it? But actually, it's our responsibility to make sure that the people under your quote-unquote care that are working for you are living a livable wage. And an immediate argument would be, well, then I can't afford it. Well, maybe then you shouldn't be able affording.
Right.
A housekeeper.
Yeah. You shouldn't be exposing someone to an undignified way of ensuring their survival.
Exactly. Because basic income grant and a social protection mechanism is one that promotes economic participation.
Yeah.
So without that, we would have seen less participation in the labor market.
Yeah. Thank you, Rachel. All right. I want our last segment to focus on a very important recent development. Viewers may be aware of a recent Constitutional Court judgment in which Black Sash and Freedom Under Law were the applicants. Would you please briefly summarize and describe what the case was about and how it concluded?
Yeah. Sure. So that case was really an endpoint of more than a decade's worth of court battles. So if I may, just in layman's terms, so there's a constitutional imperative to, you know, social protection and economic justice that is given way through a grant process.
Right.
And so a separate body is then created through legislation, SASA, is created to now disburse said money.
Yes.
But what they then do is hire a private company.
Mm-hmm.
They contract a private company to disperse said grants. Okay. That is firstly deeply problematic because who vetted whom, what structures were in place, but okay, that's not even where we're going. What we then see is that now they have access to millions of people's data. They have access to millions of people's information, bank account details. And what Sesh began to see at the beginning, the course, was suddenly complaints about debit order deductions. Suddenly had four quote-unquote funeral policies. And what we saw was as money came in, needed debit left. Then the question was, how? How are all these people suddenly experiencing deductions? Turns out that CPS, the private entity at the time, who's now gone out of business when I was rebranded as something else, and we're starting to see this creep up again, took that data and was unlawfully debiting people's accounts.
Already vulnerable people's accounts.
It was theft of people's money.
Mm.
And then when they were asked to produce, where did you get these debit order forms? Mm. How? There was none of that. Mm. None of that. So internally, they were able, not just CPS alone, even the minister at the time was also part of this case around making sure that corruption was not rooted out. So what you have is people who not only were their money taken, they were now in minuses.
Mm.
So the conversation became, who allowed this? So as a consequence of this whole thing, what's happened is that we fought for a ring-fenced account. What that means is that debit orders should not be able to go off on a current recipient's account. They can go and pay whatever. I mean, it's not a way of restricting people's movement, but it's a way of trying to protect. Debit orders should not be able to go off.
Yes.
And even if they do go off, there should be a serious mechanism in terms of how you're able to do it. That's the first thing. But then second thing is that how much was CPS being paid? By whom? Why is there the need suddenly to do this?
Mm.
And so what you saw is that the Constitutional Court found that, firstly, that contract that SASA did to give this to CPS was found invalid. But the court ordered it to continue serving grants because the court appreciated what government doesn't appreciate.
Mm.
They appreciated that if we pull them out of the sector immediately, we're going to have people with nowhere to go get their grants. So the idea was to phase them out, which just hadn't happened. But this leg now has focused on accountability.
Okay.
Who are we holding accountable? This whole thing has happened. So NetOne Technologies, which we found was the parent of CPS, had enriched itself by continuing to hold the contract after the court had said it was invalid.
Wow.
So we see a deep disrespect of the judicial system. You know, the highest court in the land tells you the contract is invalid.
Yes.
But you just carry on. You just carry on. And so this judgment brought an important closure to that saga, affirming that the state can't simply benefit from unlawful, you know, agreements without accountability. And as part of that whole process, it was the first time that a minister in her personal capacity was held to account to pay costs for the corruption that happened there.
What an important and an impactful outcome to such a tragic and enduring state of affairs. What would you say the case tells us about the relationship between state power, private contractors, and the constitutional rights of grant beneficiaries?
Yeah, you know, there has to be a serious vetting if we're even going to allow this idea that state can bring out private entities to carry out state function.
Yes.
Because if we don't, this is what happens. And why people couldn't give recourse at the time is that when they would complain, SASA would say, but it's not us. But it's not us. And CPS would say, but we're a private entity. We're not entitled to disclose anything to you. You know, we're seeing it right now with payment of grants moving to banks, which are private entities.
Mm-hmm.
When people are going to be in trouble, the banks are simply going to say to you, well, actually, no, you shouldn't be my building code, you know? And so we need to have a conversation about, one, should that be allowed? And under what circumstance? What we see the Constitutional Court says that actually, no, you can't just willy-nilly outsource, particularly when you were created to do that. The state cannot outsource its constitutional obligations to private contractors and then disclaim responsibilities when things go wrong, you know? It also tells us that civil litigation can hold power to account, even if it takes a very long time. So those who are working in civil litigation phase, in the public interest litigation space, it's to say, keep at it. It takes forever, but it does come to fruition. As I said, this was decades in the making. So the case was hard fought and it took years, but it established that there are limits on what the state can do and that the Constitutional Court sits as that judge of what is fair and what is not fair.
Yeah. And so possibly the most important question is, what does it mean for beneficiaries going forward?
So it means greater accountability, quite definitely. It also sends a strong message to deter people from future lawful operations of a bond system. Uh-huh. But what the beneficiaries need go forward is really a payment system that is properly governed,
yeah,
a payment system that is adequately funded, that has accountable mechanisms, and that centers their need. You know, earlier we spoke about the system, you know, the review and people not getting paid. That's because the system was not designed with people in mind. And so the call is to make sure that people are centered in these systems, they will see it worth. So we hope that this case, as it comes to an end, really contributes to a better framework on terms of how the state manages these things. And it shows the beneficiary on the ground that even my little complaint can get us here.
Oh, yeah. What an amazing ending. Yeah. Both to the conclusion of that case and to wrap up our conversation today. I typically end these conversations with a, okay, so what now and where to next? And that is really to invite our viewers to move from a place of only reflection to action. Would you please share your thoughts on how viewers can support Black Sash and otherwise get involved and be active participants in their communities?
Before maybe I answer that, I want to say why you should get involved. As long as we keep thinking that social justice or civil society work belongs to only one sector of society, we are going to keep experiencing what we're experiencing.
Yeah.
It's opportunistic crime. It is just people, you know, taking things that aren't theirs. It is going to be a country that is fractured. Mm. It is going to be people that feel that they don't belong. Those feelings that don't make our country a nice place is going to continue to be as long as we feel that that's not our jobs. There are people at Black Sash working for this.
Right.
It is everybody's job. Civic engagement is everybody's job. That doesn't mean quit yours, come look at Black Sash again. What it does mean is that if you want to, firstly, in your own space, you need to be the barometer for civil justice in your own space, right? So in your homes, all the people working there, if any, in your communities, people need to know that when you're there, fairness reigns.
Amen.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's the first thing you do in your immediate community, because in every community, there's always the vulnerable. But is it fair? Mm-hmm. And so once you're the barometer of that, that will spread. That's things we teach our kids, our three-day kids. And that's the one thing. Mm-hmm. But second thing is you would need to, like in the digital world, you follow, you like, you share, follow these different movements, your Black Sashes, your whatever other organization is that you support. Follow them and support their work and keep an eye on the work. And the reason why you keep an eye on the work is that if this thing is happening, you can check with your person, you know, your domestic worker, for lack of a better, is this impacting you? Mm. And then you're able to let us know that these things are happening. Because remember, sometimes the people that are facing the challenge don't know where to go. But if I came to you and I said, Geeta, this is happening, you'd be, oh, I know a session where we can go. That's the first thing. But then for those with means of supporting work, donate to these courses, donate to that kind of work if you yourself can't participate in doing it. But it's a four-step program of being the barometer yourself in your space and then making sure that you support these different works going forward and not allowing injustice to happen on your watch.
Not on your watch. Incredible. Rachel, thank you so much for everything that you've shared today. And I know I speak for the viewers as well when I thank and commend you and the rest of the Black Sash team for so bravely confronting the issues that you do day in and day out.
Thank you for having us.
As we reflect between Freedom Day and Workers' Day, we're reminded that freedom is not only about rights on paper, it's about lived realities. It's about dignity. It's about access. But most importantly, it's about individuals and collective deciding each and every day to ensure that no one is left behind by taking action and responsibility. Until next time, thank you for joining us.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.